Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. We are now nearing the end of our fourth season, and we remain just as excited as ever to continue to help you explore and understand that unbreakable relationship between your health and the health of the planet. Here we look at the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness. Here, issues like climate change, plastic pollution, extreme weather events, which we're having now, and others will meet up with everyday impacts like asthma and allergies, digestive issues and gut health, cancers, lung, heart issues, and more. So listen in today as we interview experts for today's show in our series on food production, agriculture, and land use. And today we're focusing in on land use, how it affects environmental quality and health. Now, today we are going to discuss the direct influence of land use on environmental quality and consequently on our health. Land use goes way beyond soil and rocks and the sand at the beach. It is the foundation of our existence. And how we utilize and manage land has very far-reaching consequences for the environment and for our personal well-being. And understanding this connection empowers us to make informed choices for a healthier future for ourselves and future generations. Now, land use profoundly impacts our environment and subsequently our health, and poor land practices degrade air and water quality, leading to things like respiratory issues and waterborne diseases. Additionally, land use practices contribute significantly to greenhouse gas emissions, exacerbating climate change and disrupting our precious ecosystems, which of course can then lead to the spread of infectious diseases and imbalances in all the natural processes that we depend on. There's also a global food challenge. It's estimated that by 2050, we will need to feed 2 billion more people, but the convergence of multiple stresses challenges the current model of productivity-centered investment in our agriculture. Factors such as conflict, climate change, environmental degradation, changing diets, and global health crises pose challenges to agricultural food systems across the globe. And the interconnection between food production, agriculture, and land use is indeed a complex one, and it's an intertwined relationship. Actually, half of the world's habitable land is used for agriculture. And habitable land is land that is ice and desert free. And then 70% of our global freshwater withdrawals are also used for agriculture. And actually, land use for agriculture is pervasive. Agriculture is indeed the primary human activity that utilizes land for food production. It involves the cultivation of crops, raising livestock, and other practices related to food production. The allocation and management of land for agricultural purposes directly impacts the quantity and the quality of the food that is produced and that we eat. Now, also, agriculture has a significant influence on land use patterns. It determines which areas are designated for farming, thereby affecting the allocation of land for agricultural purposes versus the allocation of land uses such as urban development, industrial activities, or even conservation. And the expansion of agriculture often leads to deforestation or conversion of natural habitats and natural land in order to accommodate more farmland. There's environmental consequences also. The way the land is used for agriculture can have both positive as well as negative environmental consequences. Unsustainable agricultural practices, such as excessive use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, can lead to some significant soil degradation. It leads to water pollution and loss of diversity, as well as a lot of other health problems that we'll talk about shortly. On the other hand, sustainable and regenerative agricultural practices, which I have taken to calling restorative agricultural practices because I think it's just a more intuitive phrase. But anyway, they can promote soil health, they can enhance biodiversity, and contribute to ecosystem conservation, which is why regenerative agriculture is all the buzz right now, or again, restorative agriculture. Now, climate change and agriculture also have a relationship that's not necessarily fun. Agriculture is both a contributor to and impacted by climate change. Certain agricultural practices, such as deforestation, which we mentioned earlier, and the use of synthetic fertilizers, contribute to greenhouse gas emissions and further promote or exacerbate climate change. Conversely, climate change impacts agriculture through altered rainfall patterns, through temperature changes, and increased frequency of extreme weather events, all of which affect, or I like to say upset, crop yields and food production. And then there's food production and food security. The interconnection between food production, agriculture, and land use is crucial in ensuring our food security. Efficient and sustainable food production systems are essential to meet the nutritional needs of a growing, or should I say ever-growing, global population. Proper land use planning and management are required for optimizing agricultural productivity and to minimize land degradation and to protect the natural resources to, again, ensure long-term food security. And we haven't even gotten to talking about the, I guess, the nations and the nation states and their various wars and other issues, as we've seen lately in terms of the conflict in Ukraine and its effect on our grain availability. Now, human health, though, is vitally affected by all of this. It deals with food safety and nutrition, agricultural practices such as the use of pesticides and growth hormones in livestock can pose significant risk to food safety. Exposure to chemical residues in food can have adverse health effects. And additionally, intensive farming practices may prioritize quantity over nutritional quality, leading to a decrease in the nutrient content of our crops and the food we eat every day. Human health is also affected by water and air quality. Poor land management and agricultural practices can contaminate water sources with pollutants, affecting the quality of the drinking water around the farmlands and livestock lands, and thus affecting our drinking water, and increasing the risk of waterborne diseases. Additionally, air pollution from agricultural activities, such as the burning of crop residues, can negatively impact our respiratory health. Then we've got the pesticide exposure, which we've mentioned a number of times. Farmers and agricultural workers both who come into contact or come into direct contact with pesticides are at severe risk of acute and chronic health effects, a number of which have been documented. And pesticide exposure has been linked to various health issues, including respiratory illnesses, neurological disorders, and certain types of cancer. And then, last but certainly not least, there's antibiotic resistance. The use of antibiotics in livestock farming can contribute to the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, thus affecting our human health. And again, this poses a significant public health concern as it reduces the effectiveness of antibiotics, many of which we've been using for years, in treating various human infections. Now, this is a lot, but here today to help us understand and unpack some of this more are two experts, and they're going to make us smarter. We've got with us today Christine Morgan. Christine serves as Chief Scientific Officer at the Soil Health Institute, where she establishes research priorities to advance soil health, and she develops a scientific direction, strategy, and implementation for soil health research programs. Christine is an adjunct professor of soil science at our own Texas A&M University, and she is an editor-in-chief of Geoderma, which is a global soil science journal, and she's also founding editor-in-chief of Soil Security. Christine has also served on the board of directors for the Soil Science Society of America. That's a lot of S's. Welcome, Christine, and did I get all of that right?
You did, Bernice. Thank you for the warm welcome and happy to be here.
And thank you for making time to join us today. And our other guest is Peter Lehner. Peter is at Earth Justice, and Earth Justice likes to call themselves the Earth's attorney, which indeed they really are with all the stuff they're doing. Peter directs Earth Justice's Sustainable Food and Farming Program, where they develop litigation, administrative, and legislative strategies to promote more just and environmentally sound agricultural systems and to reduce health, environmental, and climate harms from production of our food. Peter is author of a book called Farming for Our Future: The Science, Law, and Policy of Climate Neutral Agriculture, which he's going to tell us about what climate neutral agriculture is shortly. And from 2007 to 2015, Peter was the executive director of Natural Resources Defense Council, which is a very, very dear friend to this show. And Peter is on the boards of the Rainforest Alliance, as well as the Environmental Advocates of New York. Welcome, Peter. And did I get all of that right?
You did. It's great to be here. It's wonderful to be with you and an honor to be here with Christine.
Thank you all. I really, again, appreciate you two very busy people making time to be with us. Now, before we get started unpacking things with both Christine and Peter, we're going to go ahead and go to a break. And we'll be right back on the other side again with Christine Morgan with Soil Health Institute and Peter Lehner with Earth Justice. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, all natural grocers, all central markets, and sunflower shops, as well as many, many other locations around DFW, as well as available free online at nadallas.com, where you can download it. Check them out. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas, offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. Check them out at nhg.com. And our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today, to our show on food production, agriculture, and land use, where today we're focusing in on land use and how it affects environmental quality and health. And we're back with Dr. Christine Morgan at Soil Health Institute and Peter Lehner at Earth Justice. Again, thank you all for joining us. I want to start out, though, with Peter. You had mentioned that you worked with the climate neutral agriculture. Can you briefly, though, tell us what that's about? That's just got me intrigued.
Well, it's really our goal is what we should aim to do to have our be able to feed ourselves without hurting the climate. Unfortunately, right now, conventional agriculture is actually a major contributor to climate change. Most people, when they think about climate change, they think about factories and power plants and cars and trucks. But actually, our agriculture system, as you explained earlier, is a big, big contributor to climate change. And if we don't change our food system, we really won't achieve climate stability. Even if we do everything wonderfully with clean energy and clean transportation and buildings, if we continue with an agriculture system like we have it now, we're going to be facing catastrophic climate change. So it's really the goal of where we want to go, to have a food system that is not harming our climate, but is done in a way that is in balance with our climate. So one of the things that people don't realize is, where's this climate impact coming from? They know that if you burn a hunk of rock, a piece of coal, or burn oil, it releases carbon dioxide, and that's a greenhouse gas. But there isn't much of that in agriculture. There's some. It uses a lot of energy for tractors and all. But the real impact of agriculture on climate change comes from different sources. It comes actually from cows burping, which is not what people really think about, but actually cows burping releases more methane than our oil and gas system does in this country. And methane is a very potent gas, a greenhouse gas, so 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide over 20 years. When we over-fertilize fields, and generally for a lot of different reasons, people put on far more fertilizer than the plants can take up, that extra fertilizer can both be a water pollution and become nitrous oxide, which is about 300 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And then there's what you talked about, Bernice, and what this we're focusing on, the land use. Agriculture uses a lot of land. And as Christine knows better than probably anybody, healthy land that's not in agriculture sequesters and stores a lot of carbon. But when you dig it up and till it and convert it to agriculture, it releases that carbon, and it's no longer sequestering carbon. It's lost its capacity to pull carbon out of the air. That is a huge impact.
And I want to go to Christine, as we mentioned. I had mentioned to Christine, I recently was working on an article or reading an article and then trying to work on a sidebar to that, that connected, and it was for general consumption, but it was for people. It was trying to connect gut health and soil health. So Christine, with that in mind, tell us about how does land use impact soil health, and what are the potential consequences for environmental quality and human health?
Well, you know, we talked about agriculture and agriculture's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, soil is the foundation of agriculture. So while Peter pointed out these issues with ag, that, you know, we have burping cows, we have too much nitrogen fertilizer, and we have a lot of carbon that has been released from the soil into the atmosphere, agriculture also has a great opportunity to, you know, address these issues, right? We have photosynthesis, which does the opposite. It gets the carbon back into the soil. And so how we use our land affects our health. You know, everyone probably has heard at one point in time of the Dust Bowl, which was a time when we were plowing up our soils and it got really, really dry and the soil blew in the air, and it makes people sick. I mean, not only is it very unattractive, but, you know, breathing in, you know, particulates in the soil affect your health. I think everyone can probably, most people in the U.S. right now can identify with the smoke. I'm on the East Coast, and you can literally just stare straight at the sun right now because of all the particulate matter in the soil from the forest burning in Canada. And soil is the same thing. So we want to keep the soil on the ground. We want to keep the soil contributing to plant health for photosynthesis for our environment. But also, you know, the soil has, there are about 100 billion bacterial and living cells in a teaspoon of soil. That's 10,000 species. And we can only culture less than 1% of them, meaning if we can't culture it, we kind of don't know what it does or what it is. And a lot of the bacteria in our gut are, you know, come from the soil. And also a lot of our antibiotics, our medicines come from the soil. And so that's such a huge tap resource. So while how we use our soil affects things, soil is actually quite resilient. You know, when we make bad choices with land use, we can negatively affect the soil. But then we can also, it does heal. It's just like a cut on your skin. We can also heal the soil. And it's so important for our health to have healthy soils. And I haven't even touched food, because I think that's kind of like the easy, obvious one. You don't need a soil scientist to talk about how important food is for your health. Always eat more broccoli. That's the end game, always. But yeah, I mean, soils are just so important to everything in our ecosystems, through supporting the plants that support the animals that support us. They're also a very natural filter for water. When the water falls and there are pollutants in rainfall, there's pollutants that humans put on the ground. And the soil is a very natural filter. These bacteria eat those pollutants, and the soil cleans our water. So the soil is just so important to clean water, clean air, habitat for humans. But also they're just this huge source of a natural genetic biodiversity, and also genetic diversity for good bacteria, viruses, and other things that help humans.
And I want to dig into that and something you said just a little bit ago, Christine. You mentioned that there are antibiotics in the soil. How do they get there? Does the soil make them? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I talk about these billion microbial cells that are just in one teaspoon of soil, right? So it's this whole ecosystem that we don't even think about. But just as you walk out and maybe look at a field and you see, you know, birds eating insects and insects eating plants, right? There's this constant food web going on. Well, that food web and that law of the jungle is still also going on in soil. So there's all these 10,000 species of living things in a teaspoon of soil. They're all fighting over resources. And so it's like chemical warfare in there, right? Like they're creating different chemicals to get to the food or to keep someone, keep another living thing away from the food. And so in the creating these chemicals, just like plants, like a lot of our cancer drugs come from plants because they're creating alkaloids to protect themselves from insects, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The same thing is going on in like hyperdrive in the soil because there's so many more species, so much more diversity. And, you know, we don't even know what kind of potential antimicrobials that are able to be tapped in the soil. In fact, I was just in Seoul, Korea at a soil security conference, and there was a microbiologist there saying that there are whole new like groupings of antibiotics that are being developed, and they were, you know, found in soil.
You were at a soil security conference?
Yes.
Why do we need to address or look at the security of our soil? That is interesting.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of evidence out there that, you know, we talk about food security, we talk about water security and energy security, and I think soil's just right up there with it. Before we were on the radio, I was talking about my interest in law and how I never could make it to law school, so it was just so crazy about soils because I would see all of these global existential challenges that we have in society, like food security, water security, and soil is such an integrative process of that, that, you know, it's important to security of air, water, and food, and soil is so important to biodiversity, human health, and climate change adaptation, as well as mitigation.
Well, let me ask you this, though. What can threaten the security of our soil, just so we kind of have a better sense of what soil security is about?
The same things that threaten the security of a lot of our natural resources, you know, improper use, land use change, bulldozers, concrete, too much farming the wrong, using soils for what they're not intended for, and abusing them. Like humans are pretty good at doing that, exploiting all of our natural resources.
Yeah, like spills. Because that's the first thing, probably kind of the only thing that may come to my mind initially. That threatens soil security is like spills.
Oh.
That's where my mind initially goes. Yeah. Yeah.
Erosion from agriculture, like the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico, right? That's due to we're not securing our soils and the soil is washing away. And if we don't have topsoil to grow food, then we are insecure as far as food productivity. I think Peter wanted to contribute to that.
I agree. One of the things that is so much fun, and I'm a lawyer, but my most fun is working with soil scientists like Christine, because it is endlessly fascinating. But so often in conventional agriculture, we take this incredibly rich soil and kill it. We douse it with chemicals, so all of that wonderful stuff going on in the soil isn't happening. And so then we have to add nutrients and fertilizers to make up for what isn't in the soil. And one statistic that I've seen several times, so I'm pretty sure it's true, we lose about a pound of soil down the Mississippi River for every pound of corn we grow. And that soil goes down the Mississippi River, expands the delta, goes out and contributes to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that Christine mentioned, where the nutrients have wiped out the ability of that whole area, an area the size often of Connecticut, to hold life. And that's because we are wasting our soil. And long ago, the Congress tried to address that, but it's never been very effectively done. So we have programs that would try to prevent some of this soil loss, and they go way back. Think about the Dust Bowl that started, the beginning of the Depression. That was soil loss. That was because we were abusing our soil the way we were treating it. And so when the winds came, the soil blew away. And we've been trying to do something about that, but really those programs have not been nearly as effective as they could be. And so soil loss, both erosion and soil loss in terms of killing the soil, even if it's not moved, is a real problem.
Indeed. Thank you, Peter. We're going to go to break, and we'll be right back on the other side for more of this intriguing information about soil and land use with Christine Morgan and Peter Lehner. Thank you all. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today, to our show on food production, agriculture, and land use, and focusing today on land use and how it affects environmental quality and health. And we are back with Dr. Christine Morgan with the Soil Health Institute and Peter Lehner with Earth Justice, and they are the Earth's attorneys. And we're glad the Earth has an attorney. And Peter, I want to start back with you here. Talk to us a little bit about the impacts of what we're not doing with the land. You know, I think I mentioned in the intro here that a great deal of our land is used for farming, as is a lot of our water. So what's the impact, though, of what we're not doing with it, or maybe what we should be doing with it?
That's a great question. And actually, it's a question that isn't asked too often. It's essentially a choice. What do we do with our land? Do we use it to grow food? In this country, a lot of our land is used to grow feed, animal feed, for example. Actually, more land is used to grow animal feed than to grow food that people actually eat directly. And animal feed is incredibly inefficient. It takes about 15 pounds of grain to get a pound of beef. And so it's like driving a car that gets 2 miles a gallon. We also use about 60 million acres, that's about 2 Iowas worth of land, to grow corn for ethanol and soybeans for diesel. But it turns out that that's an incredible waste of land. So if you rented land, you would pay for your land, as you'd also pay for your seeds and your fertilizer. But a lot of land is owned, so people don't think of it as a cost. But if you rent it, you know it's a cost to use land. That is also, it's not just an economic cost, it's a climate cost, because land that we're using for something that isn't necessary, or land that we're using very inefficiently, is land that we're not using, for example, to store carbon. If we weren't growing all of those soybeans for biodiesel, for example, we could use those 30 million acres for restoring grasslands, which would have great ecological benefits and would store a ton of carbon and help slow climate change. And so we have to always think not only about what are we doing with the land, but what are we not doing with the land? What could we do with the land that might be better? And, you know, all of us make that choice every day at home. What am I going to do today? Well, if I do this, I'm not going to do that. That's a choice. And the same is with land. And yet we often really don't think about what's the best use of our land. And now, with this threat of climate change, we really need to be thinking not only about the money cost of that, but the climate cost of not using our land in the best way.
Indeed. And I think a lot of it has to do with education and information, which, of course, is the purpose of Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. And I want to dig into something that you just said, too. You said that more of our land is used for the production of animal feed than people feed. And I doubt that many of us knew that. I didn't know it. And I doubt that many of us knew that. That's rather amazing. Christine, you wanted to weigh in on that?
Yeah. I just want to point out that we eat the animals. And it's dairy production and meat production. So, you know, it is a choice that we make as a society of how we choose to consume food. And, you know, farmers, you know, most of the land in the United States, especially our productive ag lands, are privately owned. And farmers are making a living by, you know, making the food, whether it's to produce stuff to feed animals or ethanol, et cetera. And, you know, really, in the United States, so much of how we use our land is a result of policy rather than individual choice.
And maybe economics as well.
Yeah, just to throw that out there, it's like, you know, I really agree with what Peter's saying, but we have to remember that it's our society choices of how we want to use our land, not necessarily individual choices. But, you know, it's always the same thing with climate, right? It's so frustrating as an individual that all these choices to save the climate are individual. But, you know, really it's like, well, what is our, how do we convince our government to make choices as a whole that could be more effective than having Peter and Christine decide how they're going to get their electricity?
Indeed, Peter.
If I can, that is so important, what Christine just said, that farmers, about half of the land in this country is rented, half of the land is owned, but even the rented land is owned by somebody else who's choosing to rent it to a farmer. And what farmers do is so heavily affected by policy. And that's mostly federal policy, but it's also state policies and sometimes local policies. But there are billions and billions of dollars that the federal government pays every year to encourage farmers to do one thing and not another thing. There's a whole program that created the market for ethanol and soy-based diesel. That wouldn't exist if it weren't for policy, laws that Congress passed, I think, back then thinking it was a good idea. I think we now see it probably wasn't such a great idea, but it wouldn't have happened if those laws weren't in place. And that's, I think, both the frustrating part, because farmers and landowners aren't necessarily doing what may be best, but it's also the exciting part, because if we change policy, we can influence what millions of people do on tens of millions of acres. And that's what is the opportunity with the Farm Bill coming up.
Indeed. And we'll talk about that Farm Bill before we close out the show. But again, just to kind of put a nail in what you said, it still comes back to us as individuals being educated and informed so that we can drive that policy with our legislators. And again, it's challenging, but it's changing. I actually was in a meeting a couple of months ago, and someone actually knew that the cows burped methane. I was like shocked that someone else in the room knew that beside me. There was probably about 20 of us, and two of us knew that. So we're making progress in terms of people knowing what's going on so that they can help make sure and push forward policy.
And Bernice, you know, on the policy side, there is some really exciting policy outside of just the Farm Bill. Is a climate partnerships for climate smart commodities policy. It's like $3.2 billion that is being invested right now to encourage farmers. You know, Peter talked about the climate neutral agriculture. I think that's what he called it. Mm-hmm. It's the same concept of how do we encourage markets and farmers to work together to account for the greenhouse gas emissions in farming and to solve the problem for greenhouse gas emissions in farming.
And I think in terms of just us in individual actions we can take, too, for the last, I would say, last 10 years, probably at least, there's been a lot of encouragement to consumers to eat local. And they're told why it helps climate change or whatever. But in my humble opinion, I guess as host of Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, the dots are not connected well enough and often enough. Which we've really just done in this conversation. But again, I want to do that again. Would you help us out with that, Peter, in terms of connecting the dots to our audience as to why they should eat local and what benefits happen?
Sure. But first, I'm just going to compliment this show because, as you said, we were saying policy really matters, and that's going to have the biggest impact. And yet most people don't know anything about the Farm Bill. And guess what then? Policymakers don't hear from their constituents about it. And so this show, I hope, will everyone who's listening will realize, wow, we have a chance to tell our legislators that we want a Farm Bill that's going to help our climate and help produce healthy food, and rather than unhealthy food, rather than hurt the climate. And they don't have to say more than that. But if their policymakers hear them say that, wow, that makes a difference. Because right now, most of the time, they hear nothing about the Farm Bill. And so, but every one of us acts as a citizen. That's when we vote. That's when we talk to our legislators. And we act as a consumer, as a personal. And that's in our food choices. We make those every day. And that's where you can choose, for example, to eat organic because it's less pesticides. You can eat local because you know the farmer. I mean, for me, I think in many ways, the best thing about eating local is getting to know the people and having it be part of the community. You can also choose what you eat. What foods you eat have the dramatically different climate footprint as we talked about earlier, for example, eating beef has a much, much bigger climate footprint. Every bite of beef has a much bigger climate impact than bites of vegetables. And so you can change what you eat. And you don't have, all of this is not all or nothing. You don't have to become vegan. You just can shift a little bit to more eating healthy vegetables and plants, which will probably be healthier for you anyhow, and eating a little less meat, and that will be your climate impact. And then you act as a citizen, and you let your legislators know that you want policy to help farmers produce healthy food in a climate-friendly way.
Indeed.
And it really is important for them to hear that.
Now, let me ask you this. You all may or may not know, but let me know. There's also been, I think, and this may have been fairly effective, a move to get people to eat less meat, less beef, more plant from the health perspective because it's healthier for you. Are there any statistics or has the needle moved with that?
I think the needle has moved a bit. But I'm not a health expert.
Right. I've
read the same studies probably others have read that overall Americans eat too much meat and it's not good for their cardiovascular system. But I'm not an expert on that. I think the real issue, opportunity, is governments act in lots of ways. We've talked about policies, but governments also buy a lot of food. Institutions buy a lot of food. And so through procurement, they can provide other options that are maybe more climate friendly. And so when you, for a school system or something else, buy more plants-based foods, and give people the option. And right now, often they don't have the option.
They don't. Indeed. We're going to need to go to break, but we'll be right back on the other side to continue this very interesting conversation with Dr. Christine Morgan with Soil Health Institute and Peter Lehner with Earth Justice. Thank you all. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, all central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas. Offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. Check them out at nhg.com. And our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on food production, agriculture, and land use, focusing in today on land use and how it affects environmental quality and our health. And we are back with Dr. Christine Morgan with Soil Health Institute and Peter Lehner with Earth Justice, and they are the Earth's attorneys. Thank you all again for joining us. And this has really been a really eye-opening discussion. Christine, I want to start back with you at this point, and that is, talk to us about how we, or you all as experts, measure the impact of land use and management on soil in a way that's kind of affordable and relevant. And what's the impact on health and tax dollars?
Okay. Well, the Soil Health Institute is a small nonprofit. There's about 30 of us now. Half of us are PhD soil scientists. And we're all extremely motivated to figure out how, you know, if you treasure something, you measure it. And for us, it's about how we measure the change in the soil health or in the soil functioning when land use changes or when farmers change their management. But also soil scientists, they're a tough bunch. You know, we're very honorary. We don't agree with about anything. And there's a lot of soil scientists. So one of the first things the Soil Health Institute did is we did quite a large study looking at what are all the ways we can measure soil and what are the practical ways to measure soil continentally. So we've recommended this minimum suite of measurements that are accessible, like meaning you could send soil off to a commercial lab. And now we're looking at how, if we look, you know, soils are like you and me and Peter, like they're very different. Wherever you are in the United States or in the world, they function differently, they look differently, they're genetically different. But, and so that means they respond very differently when the farmers change their management. So we group soils into ways we think they're going to have similar responses, and then we go out and we measure those soils under different management practices using this minimum suite. And so what we can do is we can go into an area, say we're working with cotton farmers, and we can measure their soil fairly inexpensively and say, okay, this is how healthy your soil is today. This is how much carbon is stored in your soil. But based on the measurements in this area, we think this is how healthy your soil can get, and this is how much carbon you can store in the soil. So farmers are interested in this. Food supply chains are very interested in this. You know, not just food, but agricultural supply chains are interested in this. It's really interesting when you tell somebody this is where you are today and this is a possibility of where you can get. It is amazing how, like, we can talk till we're blue in the face about, you know, how important healthy soil is to the economics, to the bottom line, to all the resilience of their agricultural system. But when we put a number on it and then we can say this is where you are and you can be, you know, this much better, boy, the juices start turning. And farmers are a really innovative crowd. They're thoughtful. They're thinking about their resource. They know the soil is their livelihood. And they start, you know, asking questions. And so that's really, like, so our strategy is very scalable because it's a minimum suite of measurement. It's scalable because we recognize cropping systems, soil types, all these things have an influence. And that gives us credibility when we come to the farmer with their measurements and measurements locally that we're going, your soil can look better than this. And that's just kind of how we roll. In soil science, in agriculture, we look at how our soils are today and we think it's normal, but they're actually quite degraded. And showing people examples, like hard measurements to say, your soil doesn't have to look like this, it really empowers human ingenuity.
Indeed, I would think so. Last week on the show, we dug into the economics of land use and food production. And of course, that rang a bell with me with what you just said. And one of the, maybe it was the pressures that was talked about a little bit in that show, was industrialized farming as opposed to what they say really is the majority in terms of numbers. And that's, you know, regular farmers, individual farmers. But I imagine that what y'all do has really got to be exciting for the industrialized farm system, because you're telling them how they can get more money, how more productivity and eventually more money out of it all.
Yeah, I mean, we meet farmers where they are.
Right.
There are organic farmers that degrade soil, and there are conventional farmers that degrade soil. And there are organic farmers that rejuvenate the soil, and there are conventional farmers that rejuvenate the soil. We look at all of them, and we've looked at partial budgets, and we found, like, for example, the corn-soy system that Peter mentioned in the Midwest, we have found that if farmers adopt soil health management practices, on average, their net farm income is $50 more per acre. And so that's how we get our foot in the door to talk to farmers. They're like, look, it makes economic sense. And then we measure their soil and try to talk about, you know, where are you today and where could you go? And it's really inspiring to watch people's brains turn on and ingenuity turn on and the questions start getting asked. That's the beautiful thing about agriculture. It's, you know, it's biological, it's human. And if we remember those parts and try to reduce the engineering component of it, human ingenuity takes over. And it's a really positive story and lots of opportunity.
Indeed. And I'm going to get Peter to weigh in on this shortly. But the thing I want to ask, because it's going back to our core, and that is, why should people care about that? What's in that for people? As you go in and you're showing the farmers what it could be for them, what does that mean for everyday people in their lives?
Yeah, it means cleaner water, cleaner air, healthy ecosystems, And we're watching Canadian wildfires right now. And last year it was Western wildfires. Climate change is putting stress on our systems. And good agricultural practices make ag more resilient. They keep our food supply strong and our economy strong. Our natural system is more resilient, and we need resilience right now more than anything.
And Peter, I'm going to have you weigh in, but I want to ask you this question that's probably from out of the blue, but it came to my mind during this discussion. Is there a relationship or a connectedness between wildfires and agriculture?
Sure, mm-hmm. there is. Because in probably many different connections, mm-hmm. and I'm not the super expert on this, but as we said at the beginning, agriculture is a major contributor to climate change. And climate change is definitely, all the science is clear that the climate change is affecting these wildfires. It's hotter and drier, and that's affecting climate. That I think you also have areas where the whole terrain has been changed, and the soil is less rich and more susceptible. Forestry practices, and of course, agriculture is generally not in forest, but the forests are burning. And that's, of course, often nearby agriculture areas, which are even drier. But I think the main impact is probably directly through climate change.
And I guess it wouldn't, we don't have very many farms and farm crops that burn, do we?
We do. Part of some agricultural practices, not in the United States, but is burning off the residual stubble associated. And that's a practice that we are trying to get stopped.
But that's kind of deliberate and intentional, though. That's what I'm saying, though. Unlike these wild forest fires and things we have, we don't have wild crop fires like.
Right. But the land use change and the wildfires are connected. I mean, how we manage our forests has changed. And because we don't let the forest naturally burn, they build up and they create these stronger fires. But it's climate change is driving the frequency and the intensity of them.
Indeed. I just think it's very important. We always try to connect all of this for people where they are so that they get it and they understand it. Because for the most part, it seems kind of foreign when you want to connect those two. But that's why I'm always asking you all to do that. We only have about 3 minutes to go. Time is flying really fast in this interesting conversation. So I want to talk about, though, the significance of the upcoming farm bill and what's in there or how will it affect ordinary people in their everyday lives. Peter, if you can start us out, and then we'll let Christine weigh in on it. And we only have 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, the Farm Bill, I like to call the most important environmental law most people have never heard of, because it comes around every 5 years. And unlike other bills, it has to get passed. Other environmental laws haven't been changed for a long time. And it pays billions and billions of dollars to farmers in different ways, sometimes just direct payments, sometimes as very heavily subsidized crop insurance, and sometimes to encourage them to adopt climate conservation practices. And the Inflation Reduction Act, which, of course, Congress passed a couple of years ago, added some money for particularly focused conservation practices that will help climate change, help slow climate change. The Farm Bill does other things like rural broadband and other stuff. But for our purposes, they pay farmers, and some of those subsidies encourage farmers to do destructive practices. The opportunity is to pay farmers to do more constructive, conservation-friendly, climate-friendly practices.
Indeed. 1 minute to go. Christine, your last word. Weigh in on the Farm Bill.
The Farm Bill drives farmers' decisions. Farmers own the land, so it is hugely impactful. I second what Peter says. I mean, it is our natural resource legislation. You know, many farmers, I mean, the Farm Bill drives their decision making. And sometimes it's positive for the environment and for soils, and sometimes it's detrimental to soils. And, you know, we're human and we learn the impacts of some of our policy decisions. And we really want to push our legislatures to focus on policy decisions that help farms become resilient as our climate changes and becomes more difficult and more risky to grow crops.
Is there anything in the Farm Bill, though, that will impact my day-to-day living fairly immediately, or is it more long-term, Peter?
Well, it's going to impact us, A, because if we're downstream or downwind, so what the farmers do makes a difference to our air and our water, and it makes a difference to what they grow and what we eat. And that, you know, both of those is directly affecting our health.
The Farm Bill also helps set up food prices.
So we should see an impact in food prices, hopefully downward. Thank you all. We are over time, but this has been just a really, really interesting conversation. A lot of important stuff, important stuff going on. And again, our goal is to try to get people to understand it and be sensitized to it, seeing how it affects them. Thank you so much. We've been with Dr. Christine Morgan with Soil Health Institute and with Peter Lehner with Earth Justice, and they are the Earth's attorneys. Thank you all, and thank you, listeners, for listening in today to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. The conversation starts here, but our goal is for it to continue in your home, in your social circles, your workplaces, at the water cooler, and in the grocery checkout line, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Our culture is the result of a trillion tiny acts taken by billions of people every day, like yourselves. And each of those can seem insignificant, but all of them add up, one way or the other, to the change that we each live through. This is your host, Bernice Butler. Thank you for listening, and join us again next week for our last show on food production, agriculture, and land use. And listen to any of our past shows on podcast wherever you get yours. Thank you.